Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places you can go to watch movies.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in development on a bunch of others, but I'm in pre-production on one called Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 322 from August 2021 with director Dennis Widmeyer and Kevin Kolsch, who talk about their filmmaking careers, going from indie features to directing the 2019 remake of Pet Sematary and directing episodes of Scream, the TV show. You may know them from Starry Eyes. That was their big breakout film. I thought they were a good match. Well, Ulrich thought they were a good match for the Nelms brothers, because they both crawled up from indie films to studio features. Super, super interesting. After listening to the interview, you can join us for another round of The Game. But before we get there, just a quick plug for our Patreon campaign, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. All of the money goes directly to the making of the show, mainly our editor. Every single cent helps. So head on over there and check us out. Make sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Dennis Widmeyer and Kevin Kolsch. Would one of you give me the, or give us the elevator pitch?
It's not really an elevator pitch movie, but I would basically just say it's about a woman kind of, you know, very ambitious, looking to get a role in a big movie, and kind of the lengths that she'll go to do that.
Yeah.
Basically it is. You know?
Yeah. I would say, the story of the horrific lengths an actress would go to achieve her dreams.
And then how many days did you shoot?
That's 18.
Yeah.
Yeah. 18 days on that one.
Nice. Can you speak to the rough budget and what was it?
It was roughly around 300,000, I believe, all said and done.
Yep.
And then how did you guys come up with the idea for the film?
I can answer that. It was basically a combination of two separate ideas we had that worked better when merged. I had had the idea of a woman kind of coming home from a party that gets attacked by a creature. And then Kevin had been working on an idea, and he had even done a short film that he directed that I helped produce about a girl that... is destined for Hollywood and is sort of like leaving all her friends behind and is ambitious and wants to kind of go out there and follow her dreams. And we liked the idea of combining the two of them. And instead of it having being sort of like a creature that attacks her, ambition attacks her. And we liked the idea of ambition as a monster, you know, being possessed by ambition, you know.
And also, you know, this was at the point where me and Dennis were making our next film, which at first we thought we might make it as a short, just because when you're doing something DIY, you're like, can I afford a feature? But then sort of with, you know, things like Kickstarter and crowdfunding kind of being on the rise, we were like, yeah, we'll do it as a feature. But this was kind of like us deciding to make our next DIY thing and having to crowdfund it at first. So like, it just kind of felt like me and Dennis had been doing this for years. We've been working in this industry for years trying to make films. And it just kind of felt like this impenetrable cult kind of, and you're like, how do you get in? Like, you know, like how do you become an insider in this industry? So we kind of like took of all of our feelings that we were feeling as, you know, filmmakers that have been doing DIY stuff for close to 20 years and never having ever been paid money by anybody else or even having anybody else's money as a budget for any of our films, you know, like it was kind of like taking all of our sort of frustrations at that and applying it to this story. So it was kind of like Dennis was saying, merging his idea for this creature movie, the short film that I was doing about an aspiring actor, and then just kind of adding in our sort of frustrations with trying to kickstart our own careers, you know?
I'm not being funny here, Kev, but we're still in the rapid fire answer.
Yes. Okay. Yes, we are.
Well,
this happens a lot. No, don't worry.
No. Well, I was going to ask that before because I felt like the first answers, they were like, what's this? And when it was like, 300,000, 18 days.
But what you said, Kevin, is like basically the thesis of our podcast is trying to figure out how to break in and feeling on the outside. So I think we're going to get into it in a second. How long did you two spend working on the film from coming up with the idea to its release?
God, what do you think, Kev? Thought. 2 years, maybe 2 years.
Yeah. Well, I know we shot starting in April of like 2013. And I know we did our Kickstarter video. I was out recording it with Dennis in like December of the year before. Right. So like the script was already written at that point. So, I mean, if you want, I could look on the computer right now and tell you when our drafts were.
And when did it come out? It, like 2014, 2015 or?
Yeah, I played South by Southwest in 2014, and which would have been March. And then I think it got a theatrical release like later that year, maybe I want to say November of 2014.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then compared to all the other projects you guys have made, how difficult was this one?
Every project is difficult in its own way. But I would say for the most part, though, we had a really great team on this one, you know, and because we had written it, and we were producers on it and directors on it, you know, and it was really our vision, and it wasn't like a work thing that we were being brought on board for. That at the end of the day always makes anything you work on just better, you know, and you can kind of forgive all the flaws or things that go wrong because you're making your own film, you know, and we didn't really have a lot of oversight from the company that helped, you know, pay for the film. They really trusted our vision and trusted Travis Stevens, who was the lead producer on it. And so as a result, it was really a good time. Funny enough, it's a feeling we've been trying to get back to ever since with everything that we've made since, is trying to get back to that feeling of how we felt making Starry Eyes.
Well, that's fascinating. And I think we need to, because you said just a few minutes ago that you fueled Starry Eyes with all your feelings of maybe discontent with the industry. And then it became this breakout hit and you got to do Pet Sematary and you were directing episodes to Scream. So I guess, is it a be careful what you wish for kind of situation or what happened?
Yeah, I think, the funny thing is it's like, it's funny, you know, like when you put yourself into your films or you tell something that you care about or something of you is going into it, you know, that resonates with people. I think people could feel when, you know, a film is more honest or is coming from a real place within somebody. And people respond to that. And I think that is what helped make it kind of survive, you know, after South by Southwest, you know, that like it kind of like lingered around with some people. And then like, you know, and that's what like Hollywood's looking for, really. Like, it's not like they care or they go, oh my God, you satirized us. We're not working with you. It's kind of like they see, oh, you made a film and people saw it, talked about it, liked it, and it kind of lingered around a little bit. And that's what they want. They want people that are going to sort of make films that could kind of get people talking, you know?
When you say lingered a bit, what do you mean by that? Did it just like play a ton of festivals after South by Southwest, or did it get a bunch of reviews? Like, how did it have longevity after the premiere?
I would say just people are still talking about it. I mean, like Pet Sematary did well for us. It helped us. It made good money for the studio, you know, but it wasn't ours. You know, it was a work for hire. We tried to put as much as ourselves into that as we could. But I think what Kevin's saying is people saw something more of a vision in Starry Eyes, something more personal. And as a result, that film has lasted and it keeps finding new fans, and we keep seeing pop up on lists. And when people come up to us and they want to talk to us about our films, they usually want to talk about Starry Eyes, you know, and that's great because that was this little film that could, you know? And so that's a big lesson, you know, is that like, even if you're doing bigger films and stuff, always try to put as much as yourself in as you can. And sometimes you do as well as you can, but you're working for a giant studio, you know, and they have their own agenda, and you kind of have to kind of like ride that balance beam a little bit, you know? But what I mean by trying to get back to that feeling that we had on Starry Eyes, it's really just us being able to control our own material more. And even if it means focusing and doing smaller films, it's really just about getting our vision across. You know, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing to us. You know, Guillermo del Toro once had a great quote that I read that he said, I think he said it on Twitter, where he said, if you're going to fail, fail on your own terms. And so we'd much rather go do some weird movie that we write that we do and just doesn't work, but at least it's our thing, you know, and we could sleep at night knowing, all right, wasn't for everybody, but it was what exactly we wanted to do. What you don't want to have a situation is you try to do something that doesn't totally work for everybody, and it's not even all you, you know, right. Like between this whole thing, you know. So, you know, and that happens a lot, you know.
I mean, there's nothing worse than somebody, you know, saying something negative about your film and attributing it to you because you're the directors and you're sitting there going, I knew that wasn't going to work. I actually voiced that many times in the room, but like, you know, you were overridden by somebody else, you know.
Happens. Got to get used to it.
So I'm really curious to hear about like the trajectory from Starry Eyes to Pet Sematary. So is it like premieres at South by Southwest? Do you guys immediately get representation? Do you immediately go on a pitch tour? Do you immediately land Pet Sematary? Or is this like a years long process to get to your second feature?
Kevin, tell this story better than I do. It was a pretty long process. He could walk it through a little
bit. Yeah. And while we're talking about timelines real quick, I did look back in the folder and Starry Eyes script looks like we started writing it in like summer of 2012, shot it in summer of like 2013. And then it was, you know, at South by in 2014. So
wow. That's very, it's pretty fast.
Crazy.
Yeah. That's not how we do most of our other stuff.
If only.
You know, we've got another script that, yeah, we've spent like, you know, like 7 years reworking drafts of and stuff, you know? So, I mean, but yeah, the way that it worked with Starry Eyes to Pet Sematary was that we did Starry Eyes and it came out and it was getting good reviews out of South by Southwest, but it still was this very small movie and it got us attention. And it got us reps, like you were asking. We got our manager right out of South by. He saw the movie there. Then he took us on the bottled water tour, as you say. Took us around town, meeting people. He introduced us to all the agencies, and we got an agent and a lawyer and all that. And we, you know, kind of built our whole team. But then it was still kind of like our manager was going, you're still going to need to make your next step up, right? You know, like that was a very small movie. You still might have to make your $800,000 movie or your $1.5 million movie or something, you know, like, but, and me and Dennis actually attached to a few projects and, you know, we went in and we pitched on things and I guess we were good in the room, but some of the first projects we got were actually bigger than that budget that our manager was saying, oh, you're probably gonna have to make a movie like this next. And suddenly we were attached to something that was maybe a couple million dollars. And like we did a script rewrite on it. And for one reason or another, each of these jobs that we attached to and that we did script rewrites on, the movie didn't happen. Movies don't happen all the time. It takes a lot to actually get a movie greenlit. So no fault of ours, different circumstances every time stopped the movie from happening. But the studios were always happy with the rewrites that we did on the script. So the next time we went in on a meeting for something, we would pitch on it. People would like our take. They'd probably make a call and talk to their buddies at the other studio. And, you know, and we got a favorable, you know, referral. So then like we would get hired on a movie that was a slightly bigger budget than the one before that. And suddenly like the budget level of each movie was rising, even though the movies weren't happening. We weren't proving that we could make a $5 million movie or an $8 million movie. And then a $15 million movie. We were only just writing scripts that they were happy with, but we didn't ever actually prove that we could do that. And then, but we were kind of getting like, you know, a reputation then that we were, you know, getting these projects and people were happy with what we were doing with the scripts. And then kind of like, and at the same time, when we talk about that longevity, like now it was a couple of years had gone by because, you know, Pet Sematary we shot in 2018, you know, so it's been a couple of years since Starry Eyes. And then like me and Dennis were talking about, like, it kind of lingered and like people online were still talking about it. And it seemed to have like a sort of a little cult following. And then it was kind of like, and then instead of it just kind of us not striking while the iron's hot, I think actually people liked us now for projects more because it looked like we could make a movie that kind of like stuck around a little bit or stood the test of time. It didn't just, you know, cause you know, everybody loves movies when they see them at festivals, everybody like, you know, it, you're there, you're having a great time, you're with the filmmakers and everything. And you know, and everybody loves to just be supporters. It's a very supportive, you know, environment, the film festivals. But like, then, you know, when the movie kind of stuck around a little, it kind of, people were like, oh, okay. You know, like they wanted us more for these jobs. And what happened was three things sort of happened was, back when we first got our manager, he asked if he told us about projects were out on the town, and one of them was Pet Sematary. We were like, oh, we're big fans of Stephen King. We were fans of the original movie. We'd love to do a take on that. But that was when he first said that thing where he's like, you'll never get that movie, it's too big. you know, but then we spent, but they had it, and then they got a different director attached, and it was stuck in development hell like most movies are for years. And like I said, in those years, me and Dennis built up our resume and like got these bigger jobs, bigger jobs, bigger jobs. And then three things happened. Was the movie that we were supposed to go shoot that was at a pretty high budget level fell through. The director that they had on Pet Sematary left to go do something else. And then It came out and, you know, and it was huge. And everybody that had any sort of Stephen King property wanted to just kind of fast track any of them into development. So suddenly Paramount's got a, you know, suddenly Pet Sematary is a big priority for them, but they don't have a director. Our film fell through and we got in the room. And on this project that like 3 years earlier, our manager was like, you'll never get that project. You know, now we were in a position that we actually got in the room. And it was one of the hardest things we ever had to do because the pitch process was intense. We went on like six different meetings pitching, oh, come back and pitch my boss, come back and pitch my boss, come back and pitch my boss, you know, going up the ladder, pitching like six different times. And it was one of the hardest things we had to do getting this project, but eventually, you know, we got the job. And trust me, when we did, we were actually surprised. You know, it wasn't like getting called back numerous times. You're like, wow, we're going to get this. They must really like us. No, it felt like, you know, each one was like, I don't know, going up to the next end boss of a video game or something. You know, like,
well, well, yeah.
Am I going to defeat this boss? You know, so
that's what Brett and Drew Pierce, we just interviewed them, directors of The Wretched, just said the exact same thing, that you're trying to level up and fighting the big bad of that level.
Yeah. I told them guys that.
You probably
no, I'm kidding.
I'm thinking about so Ulrich and I are both directors and we're both kind of in the genre space, by the way. So it's always super, super exciting to talk to directors like you. but what I want to think back on is like, I'm now only now after my second feature becoming acquainted to this game that you guys are talking about, the pitch game, the meetings, the water bottles. I had not been aware of it before. I didn't even know the term water bottle tour until someone mentioned it in an interview. And then you said you had some affinity and some nostalgia for how Starry Eyes came together. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out how can we clarify for listeners the process differences between studio and indie. In Starry Eyes, were you also doing pitches to financiers, but it was just a little bit more control was allowed to you because the budget was smaller? Can you speak to just the process of getting that project off the ground by comparison?
It's night and day. I mean, Starry Eyes, like Kevin.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Said we had a feature film before that back in 2005, 2006. And so we'd already done a feature and it was not a great experience. It was a long post-production process. Money kind of fell through and we sort of walked away from that process, feeling like, let's just focus on short films for a while. So when Starry Eyes came along, by the way, are you hearing my wife in the background?
We can just hear you, I think.
Okay. So when Starry Eyes came around, we weren't looking to dive back into trying to make a feature film again, because it was not fun. But a couple things happened. One, everyone that we showed the script to back when it was like a 30-page script, that would have been a very ambitious short film, said, this really feels like a feature film. And we knew it did, you know, and I think we were just kind of being gun shy because we weren't ready to kind of wade back into that pool. But then it was the advent of Kickstarter. And one of my other day jobs is I manage Chuck Palahniuk, the author of Fight Club's online web presence. So it's his, you know, his Twitter, his Facebook. Kevin and I have met him a bunch of times. He's kind of my wedding. Guy's amazing. He's been in our lives for like 20 years. And he was okay with us promoting the Kickstarter to his fan base. He even said, I'll go ahead and I'll incentivize my fans to donate to your film by signing copies of my books. And I'll name six characters in my next book after real people's names. And suddenly people that could really didn't care so much about our movie, but just really cared about getting free Chuck Palahniuk stuff, were donating to our film. But I think once they actually got to our Kickstarter page, they were impressed because we really, like I said, we had the vision really laid out for the film. We had a pretty decent like 5-minute video that where we even hired an actress and shot like concept footage for the film. And so I think people were really able to see what we were going for. And then they really started to get into it. But our goal the whole time is to try to raise around 50 grand and then try to go make a feature film for 50 grand. And Kevin and I would have shot it ourselves on Canon 7Ds. We would have been producers on it. We would have been editors on it. We would have done everything ourselves. And we were fine with that. That's how we normally had done it up until that point. But along comes Travis Stevens, a friend of ours who is also a producer. He had produced Evan Katz's film, Cheap Thrills, and he had a number of films that had played festivals over the years. And we were just friends with him. We weren't looking to really get anything out of the guy. And I think it got to the point where he was waiting for us to ask him, you know, can I see the script that you guys are trying to raise money for? And so when the time finally came that he read the script and then saw the video we had put together, he was very impressed and he wanted to be involved with it. And then what happened was he came along with some money from Dark Sky Films, who had done a few of his films, and including films such as like Ty West's film, House of the Devil. And they had a cool little movie. We were fans of those guys. And so between the $50,000 that we raised for Kickstarter, another 50 grand that we got just through friends and family and personal investors, and then the rest of the money that Dark Sky brought on board, the film fell into place. So it wasn't like we were going around town pitching it. We were intent on just making it. We were raising the money already. And it was sort of like the train had left the station and people were just getting on the train, which is a piece of advice that I would have for your listeners, that if you ever are doing something independently, don't come at it like you're making a studio film. The beauty of how you're doing it is the independent approach. It's basically just go, go, go. And if people want to get out of your way, great. If they want to jump on the train with you, great. But you're not waiting for anybody and you're just pushing ahead. I mean, like you'll hear stories about filmmakers, Quentin Tarantino, the way he was originally going to make Reservoir Dogs. He was just going to go make it himself, very low budget. And then all of a sudden Live Entertainment came on board because Harvey Keitel knew them, you know, and then suddenly he had a bigger film. The difference there is that he would have made that original film. He would have made the smaller version of Reservoir Dogs and we would have made the smaller version of Starry Eyes. We weren't looking to get money for it, you know, but then when you get into the studio game, whole different ballpark. You know, you're now competing with tons and tons of other directors. And there is a whole series of people that you have to pitch to. And you have to be, they're looking for any excuse not to make the film or not to hire you. And so this is where things like the pitch books, director's books, lookbooks, rip-o-matics, all these things suddenly come into play. And I don't know if it used to be like that, but I think that because it's such a crowded industry right now, and there's so much money on the line, people just need to really kind of see the entire film before they really pull the trigger on it. And then even after Paramount was intent on making the film, they internally have something called a green light committee, where all the executives that we're working with then have to go and pitch to their bosses at Paramount. And they actually have like giant easels and poster boards and what the marketing is going to look like. And this is what the budget's going to be. And a whole series of people that are above even their pay grades and like a whole board have to either go like this or go like that, thumbs up or thumbs down if the film's going to happen or not. And to us, we were like, this is a no-brainer. This is a great book. Of course you would remake that scenario, but there's a chance that if they didn't like what they saw and we had all developed together, then that film would not have happened. And so that's really the big difference. It's just you doing it on your own and hoping that people get what you're doing and come on board, but you're doing it no matter what, versus you want to do it. Everybody wants to do it, but they're all looking for reasons not to do it. So,
For Pet Sematary, what are some of the ways you had to prove yourselves, or was the writing gigs you had leveled up on, was that enough? Or did they say like, oh, these guys still need to like do like this kind of test or this kind of thing to like, you know, make us feel comfortable with hiring them on this?
There was no test, but like, again, it was a lot of series of, going in and meeting many different people. And me and Dennis, you know, we make director's books when we go in. So we have like images showing how we would sort of shoot it. But I mean, like, if you mean like how you're saying rip-o-matics or like some people shooting test footage or something, nobody sent us away and said they wanted us to do that and made us go do anything else, you know, like, but it was just, yes, like having to like go and convince a lot of people, you know.
I'd say it was the true test was the script and our ideas for the script. You know, we weren't writers on the script, but we helped fashion it with the actual writer. And I think that because they had already a script that they had developed for years and they were all just sort of used to that script, they kind of got stale on it. And they were looking for people to kind of come along and tell them what they had and then tell them how it could be better. And that was really our big in, was we really broke the story for them and brought the script that they had closer to the novel, and brought characters into their script that they were no longer there. They didn't have Zelda. They didn't have Pascal. You know, they were kind of missing some key opportunities for iconography. You know, they were all talking about it and how it has kids on BMX bikes and it's the 80s and it's Pennywise. What do we have in Pet Sematary? We have to convince them. It's like you have a lot. You have like a cat, you have Zelda, you have Pascal, you have all these, you have the truck, the road, the cemetery, the deadfall. This, you know, the story is loaded with iconography, you know, and you have to start embracing that and not kind of being afraid of it. That's the movie that people are really going to want, you know? And they didn't, I don't think they really understood that. And even the writer was thrilled when we came on board because he had been dying to do that stuff. And so when we all sat down together, it was really just about moving the script back to a place where it would work for people who had never read Pet Sematary, never even seen the original movie, but it would also work for people who had seen the original movie and had read the book and wanted some familiarity, but also something kind of new as well. And so that was really the sweet spot that we were always trying to land on.
I'm guessing that you can't get into specifics, but if you can, please do. What kind of power and control do you have in a studio film with the contract that you signed? Like, did you have final cut? Did you have any power over, like, over studio executives when they gave you any sort of critical constructive criticism?
No. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, like, it's really just a handful of directors that get final cut at a studio level, you know, like, so like us coming in from, you know, we were lucky to even get a studio film of that size coming off of the little film that we did. So, you know, no, you don't have final cut. I mean, we're in on all the decisions though. I mean, but like, you know, there are certain things that, you know, towards the end where you start doing test screenings, and the same way that Dennis said, when a movie gets greenlit, it goes up against this sort of green light committee. And what's in the green light committee is who's front and center there is their marketing department. And the marketing department has to see if there's enough in the movie to sell it. Like, is there enough for the trailer? Is there something that could go on the poster? Because, like, you know, when you make movies at the studio level, you're spending a lot of money. And the only way to take that gamble is if, like, you know, you're going to get a return. Like, there's actually like a lot of things that a lot of the execs liked with our ideas and said, that's great. We could do that if we were doing the $8 million A24 version. But, like, you know, but we have to, you know, if you're making a studio movie and we're spending the money that we do, we have to, you know, do it the way that we feel we're going to get our, you know, money back, you know? And so, so they take those test screenings and things of the sort very seriously. So, you know, in the end, there was a, you know, in the end, right towards before release, there were some things we were overridden on because they went with the decisions that they thought the audience was voting on, you know, and like to them, that's somebody voting with their dollar. These are the people that are going to buy tickets. But before that, I mean, before that final thing, like me and Dennis were in on every, you know, we're in on every meeting. We're in on like every decision, you know. Sometimes, you know, like I said, somebody above you might have the final say on that decision. You know, we didn't always get every single thing we want, but it wasn't so, but when you say control, it wasn't like we were left out of all the decision-making processes. We were there every step of the way in the room, but just sometimes, you know, if you're at odds, you know, the studio wins, you know.
At the end of the day, it's their money. Yeah, they're going to win.
A lot of the things we talk about in the show is like sustainability as filmmakers. So like, you know, how can you actually make a sustainable career as an indie filmmaker or any kind of filmmaker, really? So the question is like, after Starry Eyes did so well at South by Southwest and you've got, you know, your new representation and you're getting hired to do these rewrites, is that it? Are you like getting paid and, you know, providing for yourself off your writing and your filmmaking solely, or was there a period where you still had to do your day jobs before you were like, you know, doing filmmaking only as your only thing that you're providing for yourself on?
I would say anybody getting into this industry, like, yeah, unless you're like Christopher Nolan or Steven Spielberg, try not to quit your day job, you know, try to have some form of, for real, I mean, try to have some form of passive income or have enough money kind of, you know, tucked under a mattress somewhere. Because with us, I mean, we haven't made a ton of money. I mean, the money that we've made has really just sustained us to have our health insurance. And it's really just been writing money, you know, like, ironically, we've actually earned more money probably from writing gigs than we have from directing, you know. With TV especially, they don't pay you as two directors. You have to split your fee, you know. Whereas with movies, the DGA honors it to where you do each get your own fee. But, you know, the money helps you out a little bit, but really you have to stay with it and you have to keep working. There's a reason why directors try to work as much as they can and they get commercials and music videos and stuff. And so with us, because Kevin and I also know how to write, like we just signed a new writing gig. You know, we're always trying to keep that going on the side because that's a more reliable revenue stream. You know, I mean, it takes a long time to make a movie, you know, and even then, you don't really get start getting paid on the movie until the first week of production. You know, there'll sometimes be a development fee, you know, but you're really not getting paid that much early on in that development process. And so it helps to have some money put away, or if you have something you are able to do on the side that doesn't get in the way of you working on, you know, your dreams and writing and trying to direct films. Keep that going. You know, that this is not like, you know, I've made it, I'm in Hollywood, mom. It's really, it's really not what it is, you know, especially nowadays.
Yeah. And I would say if it's sustainable when you're, what you're asking, that's what we're trying to find out, you know, like Dennis was saying, when we're trying to get back that Starry Eyes spirit, like when we made Starry Eyes, we didn't get any money. Like, you know, like, we started as a Kickstarter. It was our own passion project. All the money went on the screen, you know, like, so we didn't get paid for that. So like, we didn't make any money on a film that small, that indie of a film, or that much of a passion project. We didn't get paid at all. Pet Sematary, we got paid. But at the same time, like we said, like, it's not 100% your film. You don't have as much passion. And when Dennis says we choose to write, it's like, writing is sort of easier. Not only did we get more money for writing, but it's easier to just kind of sit in your apartment and sort of write than it is to kind of like go away on location, be away from your sort of family for 4 months or whatever it be, longer on bigger movies. For Pet Sematary, it was 4 months, but to be away all that time. And like, if you're just hired on a job, it's hard. You know, it takes a lot of passion to make a film. You have to care because you're really long hours, 12 hours minimum every day. Everybody's coming up to you wanting your say in every single decision. Like, what t-shirt should he wear? This one or that one or whatever. And if you don't like care, you're like, it's like, you know, the work's going to suffer. The film's going to suffer if you don't care. So like, I mean, so we want to stick to doing our own projects and things that we're passionate about. So we're trying to find that, like, we're trying to find that balance. Like, maybe it's the guys, like, you know, like I was saying at the A24 level, you know, that are doing kind of like, you know, these movies that fall in between, like the super low budget indies and like and a big studio movie, you know, these middle level kind of movies, you know, like maybe there we could make something that we is our passion project, but yet we could still pay our rent. But that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years, is like, yeah, taking some gigs for hire, writing some of our own passion projects that we haven't made any money off of yet. And we're trying to, our goal and our dream would be to find some middle ground where we could be doing those passion projects, but at some level that we could like keep our lights on, you know? And we'll let you know if we find it.
Please let us know. Can you talk a little bit about Scream? And actually, you know, we usually talk to filmmaking teams about how they divide up the labor, but I'm keenly interested in TV, which is not a director's medium, how you can have a filmmaking team at the helm of the ship, so to speak. So how did that work out?
I mean, that's one of the things in between that we refer to that basically is just work, you know? I mean, all of it's passion. We're getting to be filmmakers and do what we love. But I think what Kevin really means and what I'm saying is that there are levels of that, you know, there, no matter what, we are constantly thinking of movies and watching movies and writing movies. And we would do that even if we were on a desert island and no one was watching and there was no money in it, we would still do it. And so,
yeah. You know, oh yeah. Don't get me wrong. When we get hired for a job as directing, I mean, I'm so happy that I'm doing that instead of going into a office and like working on a spreadsheet, you know.
Yeah, we both came from that world, so you know, trust me, we're living the dream. But with TV though, it's fun because you're kind of getting a creative vacation in that you're coming on board somebody else's thing, and it's a machine, a well-oiled machine. And it's, we came on to Scream season 2, which was great. They had the same crew, same cast, and they knew exactly what they were doing, and then you're basically just slotted into that, and you get to kind of come in there and have some fun and try some certain things, and you bond with the actors. But at the end of the day, though, the show itself has a vision and you're complementing that vision. The cool thing is that unlike a smaller film like Starry's that we just come from, they have an entire truck of just toys. It's basically like, hey, you wanna shoot this whole thing in a Steadicam? We got a guy set up in a Steadicam ready to go. Whereas unlike something like Starry's, it's like, oh no, we have to schedule which days the Steadicam operates. Oh, he's not available those 2 days. So can we do that handheld instead? And like here, you're just like, there's a crane. They're like, yeah, we'll set it up while lunch is happening. The crane will be ready to go when you're done with lunch. And you're like, and it's amazing. And you get to kind of hone your skill and get better at things. And the cast is lovely, you know, and we had a really good time on Scream. We came back and did 2 more episodes for season 3, and it's fun, you know, but at the end of the day though, it's not yours. And so you're coming in there and you're trying to, you know, complement their vision, but then you don't take it home with you. You know, you're not laying in bed trying to fall asleep going like, oh man, that thing that I dreamt of that I wrote 10 years ago, I didn't nail it. You know, you're just doing the best you can, and it's a job. And so we love it for that aspect. It's, if we could do that in between movies all the time, we would, because it's kind of a way to kind of, you know, because I mean, the thing about film is, I don't know if everyone's like this, but Kevin and I are definitely like this, especially when we're working on our own stuff is, yeah, I mean, you eat, sleep and breathe it. You know, you really do. It's, I wouldn't wish it upon my worst enemy some days. You know, it's like you're just constantly worried and trying to protect this baby that you have, you know? And then when it's somebody else's thing, it's like it's their baby and you're trying to do your best to nurture that. And so that's fun because it's different, you know, and it's not as exhausting mentally, you know? And so that's what I'll say about TV. As far as 2 directors, I mean, we really handle that the way we handle our own stuff too, in that I think sometimes people think that 2 directors is sort of almost like a hustle where it's like, oh, Kevin will work Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I'll work Tuesday. We'll rotate. It's really, Kevin and I both got into this business wanting to do everything. It wasn't like Kevin wanted to focus more on the camera and I wanted to focus more on the actress. And so yin and yang is perfect. We equally want to work on the same stuff. And so whenever we come onto a set, it's completely 50-50, you know, like we've talked about everything exhaustively, you know, about every aspect of everything that we're doing. And we have to be completely on the same page because, you know, we want to read all those pages ourselves. And so when we're on a set, even something like Scream, we're standing right next to each other. We're right next to the cameraman. We're talking to the actors. It's both of us. You know, I mean, the only time is that it's one of us is if somebody else is in the bathroom, you know? Mm. And that's one of the beauties of 2 directors is that you could do that. You got to go here, guys. Like, where's Dennis? It's like, Kevin's here. Just go ahead. You know? And it's like, yeah, you got this. I'll be back in a minute, you know? And so it helps there, but it's like, no, it's filmmaking is tough. And it's very therapeutic to have a partner that you could bounce things off and feedback off. And when you're going home after the end of a long day, you could kind of discuss the day with, you know, when you internalize that stuff too much, you could drive yourself crazy sometimes. Mm-hmm. And because filmmaking is so collaborative, certain people aren't good at collaborating. Like Kevin and I are really good at it because we have to collaborate with each other. And so by the time we get on set, I've already had to convince Kevin of all the things I want to do and vice versa. And so when it comes time to convince an actor to do something, we know how to do that because we've had to do it with each other already. So for us, it's very helpful.
Dennis, when you said filmmaking is tough, you missed your opportunity to drop the name of the podcast.
That's okay. So I want to get a little bit more into process at the television level. So when you get signed on, do they just hand you a script and they're like, this is it, you're shooting it, go ahead? Or do you get a chance to weigh in at all on any of the script at the script level? And then follow-up question, when you get into post, are you involved at all in the edit, or is it more like you just show up for your shoot days and then you're done, hand off to the executives and you go off, do the next job?
You just get a script and you are on meetings. You go in and you're on meetings and you hear, you talk with the showrunners and like, you know, you could say things and, you know, you could say things back and they'll take it into consideration, but like, you know, so it's if they want to, you know, like me and Dennis would be in story meetings on Scream and we would say, oh, in this line, or what does this mean? Or this doesn't make sense. Or could this happen instead or whatever? And like, if they like your idea, maybe they'll put it in, but it's not like, you know.
Yeah, whoever show it, it's going to be their call, you know.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like we were saying, it's a creative vacation. You know, it's.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Basically, they'll have a series of scripts and your agents will tell you, hey, this show, they're looking for directors. And sometimes you'll hear there's like a couple different available episodes. You go, oh, we want to do that episode. That'd be great if you could do that. You kind of vibe for the episode you want. And then with Scream, we just got handed in season two that episode, and we loved it. I mean, we thought it was one of the best episodes of the show, and we were thrilled to have that episode, you know? But yeah, I mean, you're doing their script. You're not involved in the writing at all. Things change on set the way they always do. An actor wants to say something a certain way, or you have a better idea for how to say something, and you discuss it with the showrunner or the lead producer, and they sign off on it or not, you know? And then when it's over, the DGA, I think, Kevin, what is it, you get two cuts? You sit down with the editor.
Yeah, two cuts.
Yeah. Mm. And they leave you alone. It's kind of great. And you sit down with the editor and it's just all of you working on it together. And then when it's done, then the studio or the network comes in and they do their own cut. And you kind of meet in the middle. Like you see a lot of the things that you did, and then you see some newer things that they bring on simply because they know their own show better than you do, you know? And that's it. So you're not done with it's over. You actually get to sit down and fashion the whole thing with the editor. And so it's cool. It's cool. The things that you kind of learn when you do TV and, you know, how they kind of structure everything out is interesting.
So for a little bit of context, I'm just wrapping up my first feature film. It's premiering at the Dances with Films Film Festival in September in Los Angeles. It's not South by Southwest, but it's pretty great.
We're well aware of Dances. That's awesome. It's a good festival.
Nice. Yeah. So the question is, like, you know, what would your advice be for someone like me who's got a film that's just about to come out or had just come out and they're trying to like get their steps to get their next film made? Like, what are some of the things that like that person should be doing to like, you know, keep their career going or like use the feature to like get their next project?
I would say, I mean, there's a lot of answers to that question. I would say it depends what type of films you're trying to do, you know?
Genre, sci-fi thriller, sci-fi horror.
Yeah. I mean, first see what happens. With us, if Starry Eyes come out and nobody cared, you know, again, we would not have stopped. We would have kept going. Because we got signed and repped, there's that, for us, there was that key moment where we're sitting down with, you know, the agents and they're saying, so what do you guys want to do? What do you want to do in this industry? You know? And you're so happy to be sitting there that you sort of just say yes to everything, you know? But I think in hindsight though, it's better to kind of come in and know exactly what you want to do and try to stick to that. It's good to be open-minded, but it's also good to to be focused, you know? And sometimes you can get overwhelmed by the amount of opportunities you have. And really sometimes those can be a trap and you get stuck in development on things, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think they call it paralysis through analysis, where you'll spend like, Kevin and I spent like years just working on films that never ended up happening, you know? And I think in hindsight, that was good. And we got paid for those. And like Kevin was saying, it helped make people realize that we knew what we were doing as far as crafting a movie. But there were a lot of nights where Kevin and I just said, hey, we should have just gone and done another small movie. You know, that's again, ironically, yeah. That's what I'm trying to do right now. So depending on what sort of opportunities you get out of that film festival, don't rush for that make-believe golden ticket, you know?
yeah.
You have other things that you can do to be busy, just keep your head down and keep working, you know?
Yeah, I mean, me and Dennis made a lot of movies, whether they be short to that first super DIY feature that we were talking about before, that like that were all done like kind of like before the advancement in sort of like digital technology reached what it's at right now, you know, where people could just kind of go make their own films sort of easier. And so by the time that we actually kind of got to make a film that got us some attention, we're a lot older than, you know, a lot of the young people kind of coming out of film school now wanting to make films are. And you know, you look at how, like, you know, even Quentin Tarantino talks about how he's only doing one more film because filmmakers usually get worse as they get older because, you know, you lose the sort of stamina. Like, you know, I was saying, it's long days, it's hard work, or you know, and so that's the thing. Like, me and Dennis, we look and we go, like, we didn't get to start making films until like we were a lot older than some other people. And we're like, how many years or how many more movies do we get to make in our career? And then you look at it and you go, like, and that's what Dennis was talking about. Like, we spent a lot of those years like working on gigs or getting jobs for hire, you know, which are good because, like I said, it kept you know, the lights on in our apartments and everything. And you need to, you know, you need to make a living. So that's good that we got paid those things. But at the same time, we do go, like, did we waste a few of the precious years? Because how many years and how many more films do we get to make? You know, like, so, you know, maybe we should have been focusing on some more of our own films during that time. But it's tough because would we have been able to focus on those films if we had to go, I don't know, if I had to go get a job at In-N-Out or something, you know? And then, like, you know, so, like, then I wouldn't have the time, sort of, you know? So, like, it's tough. It's a balance, you know? Again, like, just how before I was saying, trying to find a balance between being able to support yourself doing the stuff that you love, you know? It's kind of like looking at it by how much can you sort of get away with, you know, like, you know, how much can, you know, yes, you do want to have a career and you do want to get paid, but you also do want to make sure that you're, like, you know, fulfilling yourself, you know? So, yeah. And it's a balance. It's a constant balance, you know?
Well, with that, I'm going to segue us into our last questions. We call these the final five. So what's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
Short or feature?
However you want to, whatever's the better story, really.
The first short film I made was with my buddies, whom Kevin knows, friends of ours from, like, back in our Long Island, New York days, and living in the suburbs on a cul-de-sac. It was me and some neighbors, and we basically made, like, Steven Seagal fight scene spinoffs, like VCR, you know, recorder, Panasonic camera, where we were basically just, like, pretending that our arms were getting broken and we were flipping each other around the living room and punching each other and acting like Steven Seagal out of all people. It was pretty stupid, but that was really the beginning of the filmmaking bug, you know, as dumb as it was just kind of doing fake choreographed fight scenes. So that's my answer.
That's amazing. I made one of those, by the way, so I can relate. Steven Seagal specifically too.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I did things on video camera as well. In fact, I was just back home in New York visiting family and we were watching old home movies. And like my dad had one of those big VHS recorders and I would always, like, I don't know, I gravitated towards it. I'll see that even at family parties, I would be the one to take it, want to film, but I won't consider any of those really a first film, even when I would try and do something more fun with my friends. Cause none of them were sort of complete. They might've just been like, I'm going to go mess around and shoot a thing. So I'll consider, like, sort of my first student film, the final project of film school. I did a film workshop program at New York Film Academy, and we, you did like four films over that 2 months. And the first couple I'll consider more like exercises, because they were like just little things you were supposed to be building towards your final project, which was like a 10-minute short film with two soundtracks and stuff, where like some of your others were just kind of like little silent exercises you did. So I'll consider that my first film. And I haven't watched it in a long time. So you said, well, how do I feel about it now? I don't know how I feel necessarily about it technically. I'd have to go back and watch it again. I'm seeing it in my mind's eye right now. And I don't know how I see it in my mind's eye is how it would really play if I stuck it in. But how do I feel about it? I think it's like Dennis was saying with Starry Eyes. Like, I mean, I went to this film workshop program with two of my other friends. We were our group, you know, how you get paired into groups. So it was my friends were my group. And like, and it just had this spirit of like, you know, making movies with your friends, having fun, being creative, doing any creative idea that comes to you, because you weren't even worried. Even with me and Dennis' passion stuff now, you still think of it with a, okay, this is more of our weird movie, like Dennis was saying, but you still kind of think of it with like a little bit of like, what's going to make it marketable or mainstream appeal, or, you know, that's always sort of in the back of your head a little bit and stuff. And just kind of look at the film school, and it's just you and your friends going out, and you could just do any idea that you wanted. In fact, you could try and do them. You wanted to do the more out there ideas, because you're like, oh, wait till they show that on the final day where they show it to your classmates. And, you know, like, so yeah, I miss that spirit. And I was, and I look back on it with fond memories, you know.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Well, I just spoke, but if he's not ready yet, I'll say, it wasn't advice given to me personally to a person, but the one thing that when you said talking to people and giving advice to young people, the thing that I always go back and cite is, and I never thought of it as being the best advice, but for some reason, whenever I talk to people, I always cite it. So I go, maybe it was the best advice, but on like, on the commentary for the Cabin Fever disc, I remember Eli Roth talking about how the reason why Eli Roth is a professional filmmaker is because he just kept going, because people go to film school and they get out of film school and they go like, do I get to make movies now? Like, they want to just get out of film school and make movies, but making movies is hard. And, you know, and it's tough to get movies made. And like, as we were saying, like, even like we went for 20 years doing DIY stuff before we ever got paid on something, before we ever made our first dollar that somebody gave us to go do something in the film industry creatively. Anyway, we PA'd before, but that was the first time that, you know, like, and that took like 20 years of DIY stuff. Like, you have to, no one's going to just hire you. You got to like prove yourself. And what Eli Roth said was that like, everybody gets out because there's a romanticism to making films. Everybody goes, oh my God, I would love to make films. And, you know, it's this dream job that people have. And then they get out of film school and nobody just hands them, hey, go make this film. And then like, you know, going out and continuing to make their own films that, you know, outside of the school system where the cameras are provided for you and, hey, go shoot a movie this weekend. They don't do it. They don't have to go ahead and do it. And like Eli Roth said that he watched as all of his classmates start to just give it up and go get a real job because they need to support themselves. And the person that sticks around and just keeps going is the person that ends up sort of working in the industry, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what happened with us. We went 20 years, you know, 20 years of DIY stuff before we ever got paid on anything.
Yeah. It's good advice. And at the same time, I don't know if I would recommend it. It's like I agree. Kevin and I did it, but at the same time though, if someone said, gee, like, that's what I'm going to do, I might not say like, yeah, go do that. Spend 20 years not getting paid and doing your own thing. And then maybe it'll happen. You know, like I'm not saying I'd urge someone not to go down that path, but I don't think I would be super rah, rah about like even telling my own son, like, do what dad does, you know, like, yeah. I'm deep down, I'm hoping he wants to be an accountant or like a realtor or something. That's more of a 9-to-5 than this, you know, for real. So,
I don't mean it to make it sound like a negative. I mean, like the thing that Dennis was saying before about the train, sort of. Yeah. No, like, but like, it was like Dennis was saying about the train leaving the station before. It's about like, you know, you don't get out of school and think that somebody could just hand you a movie. And then if, you know, and then a lot of other people that don't want to go out and kind of do their own thing, they end up taking sort of other jobs. So it's sort of that train is in motion thing that Dennis was talking about. Just keep doing it because you love it and because you like it, you know, just keep going out and shooting things and writing scripts because it's what you love to do. And then eventually, you know, like maybe something happens, you know, with it, or you know, like keep making films. You make a film, you know, like that other good piece of advice is write your first script. Then you know what you do next? You stick it in the drawer and write your next script. You know, just keep going, you know?
Yeah, and don't do it for the money.
If you have a goal, what is your goal as a storyteller?
Kind of like what Kevin was saying, it really is finding that sweet spot of getting to do the types of films that we want to do on our terms as much as we possibly can, you know? But at a level to where we could do them correctly. To where we're not having to go back to like the past, you know, previous 20 years and doing a DIY, you know? And so it's hard. People think that's actually, it's kind of easy to be an Ari Aster, you know, and it's not. It's very difficult to get to that place. But I mean, we would love to be able to be in that position. So that's definitely a goal.
Yeah.
Anything to add,
Kevin?
Oh,
you want it for me too? Sure. No, I agree. Yeah, no, my goals, you know, like as a storyteller is just, yeah, again, is to just be able to, like we were saying before about when we do sort of our own stuff or when we with Starry Eyes, people responded to it and still sort of like still resonates with some people because I think we put a lot of ourselves in there and a lot of our, it was honest. And yeah, and it's just, yeah, finding a sweet spot where we could, you know, make a living telling the things that we care about and that are personal to us, you know?
If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourselves?
It would be probably, don't play the development studio game, you know, give yourself a time limit, you know, and, if you get to a point where you're not close to making your next film, just push everything off the table and just focus on getting that train going. You know?
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, oh God, which one? I mean, I'd probably go back and tell myself a whole lot. Things. Probably correct a whole lot of things. I mean, you know, I mean, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's tough. I mean, I'm one of those people that believes that things happen and, you know, almost like the butterfly effect, that kind of things happen as a chain reaction to something else. And if I went back and changed something, you know, maybe I'd go like, hey, you know what? Do something sooner and take it more serious. But then like me and Dennis, we, you know, we both brought up Tarantino in this because we started making films. We're going to film school right around that time where Tarantino was like emerging and everyone wanted to be sort of Tarantino's. And like, there's a lot of people that made like, sort of like, you know, one movie that was in that kind of Tarantino vein. And then they never made any movies ever again. And I'm like, you know, if I told myself some advice to treat this more serious when I was younger and make more strides to make films, maybe me and Dennis would have gotten a film made earlier in our career instead of it taking that, you know, 20 years of super DIY stuff that I was saying. But then like, you know, who knows, maybe we would have made one film then and then like, you know, we never got to make another one ever again because the industry changed or whatever. Or, you know, like, I don't know. I think that while I look back, there are things that I regret in a vacuum where I go, oh man, we wasted our time there. Oh, why did we do that? I mean, like everything that we've done or where we are now is something that happened because of a chain reaction with everything that happened before it, you know? So if I changed something in the past, maybe I could have, maybe we could have made a movie earlier or kickstarted our careers earlier, but maybe that career would have ended after a movie or something. So, you know, I just got to look at it as, you know, we are where we are because of the chain of events that led us there. And I'm happy with what we're doing now. So, you know.
Final question. Is making movies hard?
Yes.
yeah. That lightning round. Yes.
I mean, like, you know, on your best film, you're hoping to get at least 65% of what you want in there and consider yourself lucky if you do, you know, but there's always going to be tough days and there's going to be tons of compromises, but really for Kevin and I, we live for those moments and they happen. There was a handful of them on Pet Cemetery where you're looking at the monitor or you're standing next to the camera and you're looking at the set. And not only does something happen on set that is exactly what you thought it could be, but it's better, you know? And you're going like, oh my God, this is pure cinema. Like what's happening right here. You know, like
holy crap, like it just came together. You know, everything yeah. came together. And it's just a feeling that never gets old. And no matter what art you do, you know, is when you just, yeah. it's kind of really getting nailed. And those are the moments that we live and die for, you know, that's our oxygen. And so when those moments happen, it just reminds you that it's like, despite no matter how hard this is and how long it takes and how lucky you are for able to get a film going, you know, when you get those small moments on, or even with editing, when you see something come together or you see an audience respond to something. I remember when with Starry Eyes, like it played at certain festivals and like people were into it, you know, and then certain festivals, like it was kind of lukewarm. And then we showed it at Beyond Fest in LA and it was a packed house. It was like the best screening it's ever had at like the Egyptian wow. on Hollywood Boulevard, you know, and like everything came together. The film worked perfectly. People responded to it. They were screaming and stuff. And like, I could have died right there and I would have been happy, you know? So the struggle is worth it for those moments, but yeah, it's definitely a struggle.
Yeah. I mean, it's yeah. making movies is definitely hard. And it's funny coming off the last question where if you could go back and give yourself some advice or something. I mean, I think one thing is that like maybe just fight harder to get what you want, or, you know, like, cause you just think of the things, you know, I don't know, arguments that you lose or times that you move on because everyone's like, well, you know, you're you're getting behind schedule and you're real worried about the schedule and the money that's on the line and stuff. So you move on. And then, but then, you know, you're the one that's got to forever, like, look at your movie and go like, oh man, I know there was a better take of this, or this shot could have been better and all that. And like, you know, and, you know, I mean, obviously me and Dennis aren't at any level where we could pull these things off, but you sit there and you're like, oh yeah, I don't think Francis Ford Coppola worried about the schedule when he was making Apocalypse. You know? You know? But, you know, but like, you know, you're like, oh wow, they were like a year over schedule and behind on budget or whatever. And I'm not saying to do that. Me and Dennis are very, you know, responsible guys with, you know, watching the clock and doing all that. But, you know, like, but, you know, at the end of the day, like I was saying with some of those other things, our names are the ones that are on it as director. We're the ones that are held accountable for anything in the movie. And then I look at it, and there's certain things where I go, I'm being held accountable for that, but I didn't like that idea. I should have fought harder for what I thought was the good idea there, but we were overridden. Or I know there was a better take of this, but, you know, I felt the ticking clock and I was like, okay, let's move on. And, you know, nobody knows about the ticking clock at the end of the day when they're watching your movie. They're just seeing the movie, you know? So like, you know, so coming off of the, is making movies hard? Yes, those are all elements of what makes movies hard. And you move on sometimes and you leave something the way it is. And you didn't even get it the way you wanted to, because all these elements are very hard, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just get it on screen. That's all people care about.
I know that we're running late, but just want to thank you for being on the show.
Oh yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And then where should people go to find out more about you? Like, do you have Twitter? Do you have Instagram? Where are you for people to find your movies and follow your careers?
I mean, we have all that stuff, but we really don't, you know, we're pretty focused on writing right now. So it's not like we have some online brand. I would say when something comes out or something's coming out from us, you'll definitely hear about it. And then you'll probably see us more on Twitter. But, you know, that's the other piece of advice we would give is, stay off social media.
Yeah, I mean, you're like, where can you find out more about you? You know, if you went to my Instagram, all you're going to find out more about me is what craft beer I was drinking this week or something. It's not really all that exciting what you're going to find out there.
Yeah,
well, that's so funny.
But my cats ate for lunch.
Yeah.
As a non-social media person or a failing social media person, I feel a little bit better about that.
Yeah.
Alric, if Dennis and Kevin were on the show today, what's the one question you'd ask them?
Well, I'd really want to hear about their new feature that's in pre-production, The Swallows, or Ooh. The Swallow, which I think has been in pre-production for a minute. Yeah, I'd love to hear about like what's going on with that project and like how things have changed in the last 3 years since we had them on the show, or almost 3 years. Yeah, I mean, I feel like you look at their IMDb's and there isn't a lot of action, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they haven't been busy doing lots of things and rewrites and stuff. So it'd just be interesting to hear what their journey through filmmaking has been since we last had them on the show. And yeah, I don't know. I just feel like I really like this combo with the Nelms brothers, because I just think that they're such a nice complement to each other in a lot of ways, because they're similar, but yet they're very different. Like, you know, the Nelms brothers have made a lot more movies, but they're also kind of on similar trajectories. Although I believe that Pet Sematary was like a much bigger budget than either of the Nelms brothers' other movies, because it was like a true studio feature, not like, I think it was like 80 million or maybe 40 million or something like that. Like it was a bit bigger, you know, but it almost feels like sometimes when you get so big, it's like the machine that moves you to your next project moves a little slower versus like the Nelms brothers, like in the $10 million range. It just seems like they rolled right from one feature to their next feature, you know, which is like, personally, like, seems more attractive, right? To like be in a zone where you're more active as a filmmaker. But again, like, you know, if you want to be in the big leagues, like, maybe you have to. Maybe it's just a slower process. Like, I don't know. It's very fascinating. It's all very fascinating to me. But what also is very fascinating is that we have a game question for the week. Now, for all you who have never heard the show before, this is called The Game. Or The Game, however you'd like to say it. And it was invented by our producer, Eric Toms. And this is basically a scenario, a challenge, of an indie filmmaking challenge, where you are given a scenario and then had to basically figure out the solution to this like tough situation that you're in. Because anyone who's made a movie knows that you're always in tough situations all the time. There's always disasters. There's always things that come up that you cannot control. And being able to like think on your feet and figure out a solution is really great. And it's just also fun. It's fun to do. We kind of did this a couple times, and then Liz and I were like, well, we want to do this every week. So we make poor Eric come up with new questions all the time. But here is our question for the week. Liz has not heard this. This is the very first time she's hearing it. It's going to be completely blind. I started reading this a couple days ago when I first got it sent to me, just because I was curious. And then I was like, no, it's more fun. It's way more fun to read it blind. So I only read half of this. Here we go. You are gearing up for a short film shoot that will show off your skills as an action director. You plan to shoot a big fight scene with multiple characters on wires in a very cinematic location that has been donated to you and therefore is free. Wow, amazing. However, you only have the location available to you for the next 2 weeks. You have a stunt choreographer who is helping you find capable and professional stunt people, but they have some issues. They tell you that you'll have to hire a stunt coordinator as well as an on-set medic in case of injury, and you'll need everyone for multiple on-set rehearsals so the stunt people can get the choreography down. They go on to tell you that location ceilings are too low for wire work, and you'll have to find a different location with at least 20-foot ceilings, which will mean more money. As this process goes on, your costs are skyrocketing. Tell me about it. Do you, A, continue with the current location but hire a different stunt choreographer and try and find plans for a wire rig set on YouTube that will fit the space? Okay. Forego the free location, wait and raise more money so you can accommodate all of the stunt choreographer's requests. Dramatically cut down the scene, shorten the fight, and forego the wire rig so as to keep costs down and still use the free location. Other, what do you do, director? What do you do?
This is a hard one, I think, because I'm not really into action film, but I'm presuming that the fight is like the centerpiece of an action film and is pretty important. And a lot of exposition leads up to the fight. It's kind of like climactic moments in an action film are stunts and fights and explosions. And so it feels like I'd be curious why wire work is required for this fight. And is there something about the choreography of this fight that's so novel and inventive that it's why I want to do this action short? Or if it's not, and if it's slightly arbitrary, then I think what I'm leaning towards is just re-choreographing the entire fight to work with the location. Because location and a stunt coordinator and an on-set medic and all these things are going to rack up a pretty high price. But the most important thing is that my actors and my stunt coordinator are safe and that we're there to support them if something bad happens. So I lean towards adjusting to just make the fight work with the location and maybe not doing it on wires. Like, Ulrich, I'd be curious, are all fights on wires? Like, is there not a world where we can just do some beautiful, full, novel fight choreography without wires?
Yeah, well, it depends on the type of action movie you're making.
Right.
If you're making like a kung fu, you know, whatever type movie where you want people jumping in the air and flying around and everything, then like you probably need
that's
wires.
That's pretty important, yeah.
But it doesn't specify, right? It just says an action director. So like as an action director and as an action film lover, I know that you can do all kinds of things without wire rigs. Like
right.
You don't need to have a wire rig to do something cool. There's all kinds of other types of rigs that you can use. And there's other rigs that you can use, like the R-wire rigs that don't necessarily need to have high ceilings. I know this from experience. So, you know, you can do pulleys. You can do all kinds of things. Like we did pulleys in my movie in the Strange Thing to like get a character sucked into our office, you know, and we did it in my tiny little apartment. So, you know, if you have 10-foot ceilings, I know you can do something, or 15-foot or whatever, like not 20 feet. If it's less than 20 feet, you can still do some really cool things. So I like your idea. I think that I would work with the amazing genius stunt choreographer that I have, look at the location that I have and make it work, and then provide all the things that they, you know, obviously, yes.
Yeah.
Stunt, you know, stunt
the
coordinator,
medic.
The medic. Yeah. Let's do it. Like, of course you need those things. But I think like putting it in perspective, like we both know that like locations can be extremely expensive and can easily be the one of the more expensive things on your movie. And if you need it for, you know, 2 weeks for like all this rehearsal and all this training and stuff, and you have it for free already, use the one that you have. That's like, isn't it mentioned that it's like a very cinematic location too? So yeah. Like I would work with the gifts that you've been given and make it awesome, you know, and don't get hung up on technique and like, oh, this can't support the wire rig I want. Like, who cares? This person's a professional. They're going to find other really cool things that you could do in the space that you have. And, you know, if you've got that time and you've got that space and that crew already built, this thing is going to be sick. You just need to like lean into what you have and listen to your people, because you hire them for a reason. I think the thing that happens sometimes, not always, but I think especially with younger directors and more new directors, is they think that they need to be the ones to decide everything, and they have to be the ones to come up with everything and be like, this is my genius plan and I know the solution and blah, blah, blah. But it actually, what's the best way to work is to lean on the people who have more experience than you and like say, this is what I was thinking and I want it to be like this. And then let the person say, oh, well, given what you have here, what we can do is this.
Yeah.
And then you'd be like, yeah, and then you add on to that, and then you're running, and then you got something super cool that you're going to build that's like greater than what you could have come up on your own, and then also probably 100% different than what the stunt choreographer could have done on their own. It's like you put your two minds together, and then you come up with something awesome. So, yeah, I wouldn't look at this as like, you know, oh my gosh, like I have to go on YouTube to find a wire rig. Like that's the exact opposite. Like you don't want to go rogue. Like you want to lean into the professionals and let them guide you. Great question, Eric. We haven't had a question quite like this before. This is a really good one. But what do you guys think? Am I wrong? Have you gone on YouTube and found your own wire rigs and has it worked well? I bet almost not ever. No one's going to say that it has. But if it has, I would love to know. But you can send us those answers and other questions, comments, and suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. We love those. Those are great. Ratings are also good, too, but reviews are better. See, Smokey agrees. He says, I want more reviews. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Breiman, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to you on Monday.
Hey there!
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.